Hello and welcome. My name is Alex MacPhail and this is High Performance Teams. I'm a former aerobatics display pilot from the South African Air Force and I love talking about high performance teams, what makes them work and what we can all learn from them. In the show, we talk to race pilots, professional sportsmen and women, entrepreneurs, comedians, performing artists and more. Please enjoy and remember to subscribe. Good day and welcome. Very excited to have my guest today, Willie Cruikshank at the World Championships Air Race Podcast. Willie, great to see you. You're looking fresh and happy and excited. How are you doing today?
Great to see you, Alex. I'm good. Yeah, really good. It's a Friday morning and that's a great place to be.
Well, for me, the last few weeks, Friday has been fly day. I've been getting back into light aircraft flying, not too dissimilar to the aircraft sitting behind you there. And Friday is a good day for a conversation about all things flying.
Yeah,
I want to just go back. I want to go back just a while, just so we can set the scene here for everybody who's listening. Formative years for you. What was your influence? And, when I say formative years, 14 to 18, that time in your life, what was it that that made you look to the skies? What made you excited about flying and eventually joining the Air Force?
Yeah, I don't really know, Alex. There's nothing in my family that goes back directly linked to flying, but just from my earliest memory, I can remember just thinking all I wanted to do was fly and be a pilot. I remember vividly sitting in school classrooms, looking out the window at contrails going through the sky above Edinburgh, where I was at school, thinking, you are the luckiest people alive. I wish I was up there doing that instead of sitting down here. It's all I ever wanted to do. I didn't have a plan B, which was maybe a little bit naive of me at the time, but I just wanted to be flying. That was all I wanted to do.
And that's not dissimilar to lots of other pilots that I've spoken to. No plan B, all in on plan A, which is great. You know, it does allow you to focus. And obviously you had the right aptitude, you had the right school marks, and I know you go into gliding at a younger age too, but applied and joined the Air Force, a little unconventional in that you went the navigator route first. Tell me about that experience, working in a team environment where you were supposedly being sort of more a supportive role in the backseat, fast jet fighters, and then the conversion over from being the weapons operator, the navigator, to being a pilot.
Sure. Yeah, well, it was at the time, it was an unconventional route into the front seat of a jet, but subsequently there have been others that have done the same thing. I was part of a group of guys that did it at the same time. So back in the early to mid 80s, the RAF was replacing its single seat Lightning fighters and Jaguar fighters, some of the Germany based Jaguars, with two seat Tornadoes, and that meant they were in urgent need of finding some navigators to fill the back seats. So when I applied to join the Air Force, it was, what do you want to be? And I said, I just want to be a pilot. And of course, the guy in the recruiting office said, you know, if you also say you want to be a navigator, it will show that you're really committed to the Air Force, and that'll help you become a pilot. You know, it'll work in your favor. Of course, it didn't. It just said, great, we've got another guy here who said he's happy to be a navigator. So I was offered a place as a navigator straight from school, and I got in touch with the RAF schools advisor, a wing commander guy at the time, and I said, what do I do? And he said, yeah, get to Cranwell, and as soon as you get there, say, you know, there's been a bit of a mistake, and I'm meant to be a pilot, and you know, they'll sort it out there. I went, oh, that's great, yeah. So I went to Cranwell, started training, officer training, and said that to my course instructor, and he went, no. Just get your commission, you know, get some credibility, get your commission out of here. When you get to nav school, say there's been a mistake and actually I should be a pilot, not a navigator. So I passed out of Cranwell, went straight into nav school at RAF Finningley, and day one, put my hand up and said, I'm sorry, there's been a big mistake. I shouldn't be here. I'm meant to be a pilot, which is not the thing you should say on day one of nav school, in front of hundreds of navigators. But anyway, I knuckled down, went through nav school, and then straight onto the Buccaneer. And it's interesting, you said, you know, their supporting role. Actually, in two-seat fighter aircraft, they're equal roles. One doesn't support the other any more than, you know, vice versa. It definitely was a team effort. You know, one person couldn't operate that airplane. It was complex when you're doing maritime strike attack, flying out over the North Atlantic, or up through the Faroes Iceland gap, looking for shipping targets. You need to work as a team to be able to gather together all the information and analyze it and then come up with a plan to use it. So it was great. I really enjoyed being part of a crew. I loved being in the Buccaneer Force. It was great, an amazing aeroplane. I think only the Brits and the South Africans used them. I remember when it came to the end to retire the Buccaneer, people said, "What should we get in its place?" And the answer was just a new Buccaneer. That was what we should do. It's great aeroplane, and I loved it.
It's a wonderful aircraft. There's a gate guard, a Buccaneer on a pole about 4 kilometers from my house. And sometimes I go cycling down the road and I see it there from over the wall because it's sitting quite high up. It is just a beautiful, beautiful aeroplane. Lovely to see it fly. Well, there was one flying on the air show circuit in South Africa in the last 10 years. And that the sort of striking image that stays with me is that bleed air over the wing. You see those puffs of condensation, the moisture. It's a beautiful thing. It's beautiful in the air. It's beautiful on the ground. I've never been inside it, but I must imagine it must have been beautiful from within the cockpit.
Yeah, huge cockpit, actually. And it looks like the pilot and navigator sit directly in front or behind each other, but they're offset. So as the navigator, you sit slightly offset from the pilot. So you do have a direct view out through the front windshield as well. But it's a big aeroplane. I mean, you can stand up in the back cockpit of a Buccaneer. It's big.
I never
realized.
Great fun. Yeah. Okay, so you highlighted an important point there, which is really the I didn't say it so eloquently, but the point being that it's a team environment, and as you put it, you know, there's no one way or the other. You both support each other in order to operate this aircraft. Can't do it on your own. Well, early years and formative in your aviation career, understanding the value of team is probably something that's carried you quite nicely through. I want to fast forward a little bit to getting into the flying side. Obviously, you showed your aptitude on an evaluation. They selected you and you ended up in the fighter line years down the line. As you started to approach sort of more senior roles, you know, flight leader, strike leader, weapons instructor, and approaching flight commander and squadron leader, what were the lessons that you learned in the early stages of being in this team environment? Even though we look at Tom Cruise, Top Gun, and we think a fighter pilot and his big ego, what were the team things that you learned early on that you carried through to being in a senior position as an RAF fighter pilot?
I think the big things that I picked up were trusting in other people to do their job well. You know, don't micromanage. Whatever it is, whether you're leading a formation or whether you're leading a squadron, you've planned it, you've briefed it. Everyone knows their role on that mission, in the air or on the ground. So just let them get on with it. You know, if you've got tactical information that you can provide them or even provide tactical direction to them, then that's fine. But, you know, get out their cockpit. Just let them fly their aeroplane. They've been selected, trained, and put in that position because they are incredible people. So just let them get on with the job. And that really was, I mean, it's such a narrow pipeline of selection to become a frontline fast jet pilot. You do end up with incredibly talented people to work with. And when you've got that in place, just work with them. And that feeling of elation when you come back from a successful mission because the team has gelled and worked together is, you know, way exceeds anything you can ever do as an individual. That team spirit, esprit de corps, camaraderie, whatever you want to call it, is just the most exciting feeling in the world.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I echo that completely. Formation aerobatics is something that I had that sort of intense feeling of being part of something bigger than you. And, you know, frontline fighter squadrons, you regularly transversing the skies in this formation. You're going on strikes, operations together, 4 ships, 6 ships, you know, big formation get togethers. There's a lot of trust involved with 2 aircraft flying very close to each other, but also on these attacks, you know, operational tours, etc. But I wanted to really just sort of summarize and highlight this time with the Air Force of your career. You know, you spent a long time there, 3 decades. What would be the sort of overall feeling that you got of being an Air Force pilot and culminating at the point where you're very senior squadron boss of an aircraft, the Jaguar, that you liked very much? It's a beautiful aircraft, very capable. What would you say, looking back over your career in the Air Force, both being a fighter pilot with all the esprit de corps and trust, and being that person in the leadership role, being able to share and give back to others, what is that one thing that you'd say, I'm glad I went there because I got to do this?
I'm glad I went there because not one single day felt like I was going to work. It was a phenomenal experience. And I'm hugely grateful for everything I got to do, you know, traveling the world, being with great people, whether they were, you know, my squadron people or people from other countries. Working in coalition operations in the air and on the ground, meeting like-minded great people. It really was a fantastic opportunity. I learned a huge amount, and I learned a huge amount from other people. I I hope I passed on some of what I learned from the guys that I looked up to. I hope I passed some of that on to the guys that followed me. And I love being an instructor as much as I enjoy being, you know, a frontline pilot as well. Seeing somebody go on and progress. And now, you know, guys that I trained on the Jaguar operational conversion unit, you know, 25 years ago, are now group captains running Typhoon stations. It's great to see.
Yeah, the full circle moment. I also, you know, students of mine have gone on and retired from the Air Force as a major. You know, we have these 10-year, 15-year contracts. Retired as a major. I taught them to fly all those years ago. It's the circle of life continues, and we're on this journey. I want to share one more story. So having a chat with Rory recently. So, you know, a child of the Air Force must have been a wonderful thing. My children were born after I left the Air Force, but he tells me that there was a certain birthday party. I don't know if it was the 11th birthday party or what. He had some friends come over and there was a 10-ship formation of Jaguars. What a joy for a child to see dad and nine buddies flying over in their fast jets as a fly pass for your birthday.
Yeah, that was just convenience. there was a local event taking place in Norwich, where we lived, and there was an RAF parade as part of that local event. So we were doing a fly past over that, and it just so happened that we could then link up going over Holmes' back garden on the way back to the airfield. But the funniest story that I've got from that flight, and it will stick with me forever, was you can relate to this as being a formation display pilot yourself, Alex. Was we were running in, so we're a 9-ship and a 10th aircraft being the whip, you know, telling us that we were looking good in diamond, and we're running in. I've got these 9 Jaguars, you know, around me, running into the fly pass point, and we're about 90 seconds out from the datum point. And my number two, a guy called Mark Discombe, who's currently the officer in charge of the Battle of Britain Memorial flight. And we'd gone through fast jet training together, just came up on the radio and said, "Hey, is anyone else showing 1 minute early?" And he was like, "No!" And then he went, "Only joking." But that was like a heart beating moment. But it was good. And then so we came off the fly past, right hand turn, rolled out, and straight over the birthday party on the way back to Coldshall. It was good.
Oh, wonderful. Those wonderful, wonderful memories. And, you know, Certainly not many people get to experience that kind of thing. And very, you know, very fortunate childhood for Rory as well. Now, just to tie in a couple of things there, one being that you mentioned the sharing the joy of flight as well, and this opportunity in the Air Force. And the Air Force is obviously there, the sovereign, protect the sovereign skies. There's also times as a show of force. There's also times used as a an opportunity to display what does the military offer, you know, in the RAF. What can you do in the military? And certainly a team like the Red Arrows, they fly around and they showcase engineering and British aerospace, as well as professionalism, training. You know, there's a whole aspect to the reason for a display team like the Red Arrows. And when you talked about sitting in school, I sat in high school in 1995 when the Red Arrows flew over my school in the southern tip of Africa. It was a beautiful thing to see. Wonderful. And, you know, wonderful for me all these years later to join the South African Air Force display team. Not quite as impressive as a 9-ship Hawk aerobatic team, but it certainly a wonderful opportunity to then be involved in air shows, be involved in that time of your life where you're giving back to aviation. You know, you've also mentioned meeting and mingling with people in the air show circuit when you left the Air Force. So I want to just spend a few minutes on your time leaving the Air Force and getting into this PITS aerobatic team. So how did you go about getting into the PITS aerobatic team and your experience on the air show circuit?
I got into the PITS aerobatic team. When I retired from the Air Force, you get a... because I'd done right up to my 44 age point, I could leave the Air Force and get a pension, a monthly payment. But also I could take a chunk of that in advance. So I took as much as I could up front as an advance and went and blew the lot on a Pitts S2B, which was a pretty nice. Gutsy move at the time, I guess. But I bought a beautiful Pitts S2B. And then with a guy that I'd met locally, a guy called Al Coots, who had built many Pitts S1s and at the time had a Pitts S2A. We then stripped it right back down, changed all the components that needed changing, recovered it and repainted it so that we had two matching color Pitts. And we formed something called the Wildcat Aerobatic Formation Display Team. And we just, you know, pretty amateurish to start with, set up a little routine and started with little local events, and then it grew and grew. After about a year, Al decided he wanted to upgun his aeroplane, so he traded his S2A in for another S2B, and we had a pair of them. And we, you know, over the next 8 or 9 years, we flew over 100 public displays over UK, Europe. You know, some great flying experience memories of my life come from flying as part of Wildcat. You know, when you're flying in a Pitts S2B with, it's got an altimeter and an ASI and a VSI, and that's about all you get in it. And you just get on and fly. And it was great fun flying. I loved every part of it.
I'm sure this was a big, go for it.
I was going to say, yeah, you asked about, you know, on the ground, and it was Al and I had both grown up in Scotland, going to air shows and, you know, being in awe of what we could see. And we both felt that at our stage of life, we wanted to enthuse and excite younger people to get into flying as well. And we had lots of initiatives we did. We had the Wildcat Cubs and things like that, where we'd go to air shows and we'd spend lots of time on the ground, giving out postcards and stickers and, you know, letting people sit in the aeroplanes and just trying to make people think that flying is cool and they can do it. And that's what it was all about, really.
And real and tangible. When you sit and talk to the pilot in his uniform, you can touch the wing of the aircraft and sit in the cockpit. It feels so much more real that you can see this is just another person. Sure, you have to put in the work to get there, but you can do this too. I also, the air show time was really a nice time to kind of give back and just see people that are, they're just besotted with this thing. You've done something incredible, but really, as you said earlier, it wasn't even a job. It was just something you loved doing, and an incredible opportunity to be involved in. And 10 seasons you're involved there. How did you guys operate in terms of leader and wingman? Did you mix it up?
No, we kept the same all the time. So Al was always the leader. I was always the wingman. So I was always the one that was out of position. You know, it was never his fault.
Right.
No, we did. Well, I mean, you go back to that leadership thing about and teamwork, trust. You know, formation aerobatics is probably one of the pinnacle activities when it comes to having ultimate trust in each other. You know, whether you're going head to head at 400 miles an hour closing speed or whatever you're doing, you know, you're coming out of a loop and you're just clinging on to the wing of your leader. He's the one that's responsible for, you know, terrain clearance and avoiding everything else. And you just have to say, I trust you to do your job properly, and he trusts me to do my job properly. And if we both do our jobs well, we do a good show.
Yes, it's a great way of putting it all together. You know, and it doesn't help, you mentioned earlier too, have trust in your person that they're going to do the job properly and don't micromanage them. Imagine if you were the number two in the formation trying to micromanage the leader, what's the right height or amount of G to pull out of the bottom of the loop. You know, you're second guessing what he's busy with, but actually the most important thing is you're not concentrating on station keeping. And if it was the other way around, if your leader was now pulling out of the loop and wondering, well, is he right? Is he in position correctly? Does he need to step it up? And he's concentrating what the wingman's doing. He's not concentrating on keeping the safety altitude for this formation. So it's a great example of have the trust in the team, brief well, execute with precision, review what you've done, but give that complete trust and authority to the person that's supposed to do the job to get on and do the job, and the results will speak for themselves.
Yeah, I think if you retain the that right of intervening and saying something for when there is an absolute, you know, essential need to say something and react, then people, when they hear your voice, they go, what is it? If there's somebody just incessantly chipping in, then you tend then not to be alerted when someone comes up and says, you know, brake left or whatever it is that you've got to do. So it's important that you just use that radio when you need to, rather than just constantly getting in each other's cockpits.
That's right. Okay. Now, so this time in your life now, it's 10 seasons on the airshow circuit. I mean, some would consider you a veteran of the airshow circuit with having 10 seasons. Obviously, you got exposed to lots of different things, and then the Red Bull Air Races come across your desk. So how did you get involved in Red Bull Air Races?
I kind of got into that because one of the guys that I knew in the air race contacted me and said, hey, these guys are looking for someone to come out and head the aviation and sports department. We think you'd be interested in it, are you? And I said, yeah, I'll take a look. So I got in touch with them, went out to Salzburg, had an interview, and then went back out there 3 months later and started the job. It's great fun.
Okay, so you worked there, I think it was around 2 years you were part of the Red Bull Air Races towards the second iteration of it, and the sort of last bit of time you left just before it closed down. But what was your day-to-day job doing the aviation and sports? What would you do on a day-to-day basis?
So I was there for just over a year, and it was no 2 days are the same in something like the air race. Aviation was everything from planning future race events, getting permission from a local aviation regulator to do what the air race did and does, planning tracks, designing tracks, liaising with the race teams to make sure that they're all happy, liaising with the technicians to make sure that the technology that we're developing is all going well, liaising with the teams to make sure that their modification programs are within the regulations, amending the regulations, lots of communication with people. And really, it was my personal job was more about that leadership and coordination aspect of it. You know, there were experts that did permissions, experts that looked after the rules, experts that looked after the technical side of things. Mine was kind of just bringing them all together and trying to keep a happy family going.
Okay, so I mean, it must have been wonderful skills that you'd learned in your 3 decades in the RAF. I mean, culminating as a squadron boss of an operational squadron that is deploying. As a squadron operates, you've got a weapons officer, you've got a flight commander, you've got a training officer, you've got all these key positions that manages the different disciplines within the squadron. And the squadron, not only that, but the squadron deploys and actually has to go and do things. Must have been a wonderful experience or a wonderful opportunity for you to sort of lean on all those skills built all those years ago to now develop a similar thing, although there's no warfare, but you need these experts in your team and you are deploying. You're deploying, you know, 10, 12 times a year. It must have been a great experience to move the skills learned in the military over to a civilian life in a semi-air show arrangement.
It was, but it wasn't that cut and dry. So my, you know, in a squadron, you've got an XO, the executive officer is your right-hand guy that you work with on everything. And it was the same at Air Race. And my right-hand guy is a guy called Jim DiMatteo, who was a US Navy F-14 pilot and went on to be the commanding officer of Top Gun. And Guido was the race director, and he and I worked hand in hand to make sure that the race was planned and executed safely and effectively. And, you know, it was great having that similar military mindset of get on and do it. And actually the US Navy have a more similar mindset with what I would say from the RAF than the US Air Force has with the RAF. I found that we had a lot in common right off the bat. You know, we're still great friends today and can't wait to be working together again soon.
Okay, well, that brings us to that. So let's get into the exciting part. Now, World Championship Air Race is about to commence. You know, next year is the initial season. And it really is, as you've said before in other interviews, this is the World Championship Air Race begins now. We're taking what the lessons were learned from Red Bull Air Race. They've done a great job in the first and the second iteration of it. And you're taking a lot of the good and building upon it. So talk us through, what is World Championship Air Race?
So World Championship Air Race is building on the legacy of the Red Bull Air Race. As you say, for many of the fans of the Red Bull Air Race, they will be able to look at World Championship Air Race and 90% of what they see in front of them, they'll recognize. You know, it's the same pylons on the track because we've bought the pylons from Red Bull and all the other equipment that goes with it. A lot of the same airplanes and pilots because a lot of them are coming to race in this championship. And in terms of people that are keeping it safe and organizing it, they're the same as well, like Jimmy DiMatteo. And that's because those people built up 16 years of experience, unique levels of experience in putting an event like this on. So, you know, securing their involvement was absolutely key. We're very fortunate also that we've got people like Paul Bonham and Nigel Lamb, previous world champions in the World Championship Air Race, as part of our advisory board, and Steve Jones, who was the head of training at Red Bull Air Race. So, you know, we're bringing all that expertise together. But we are different. We're not Red Bull Air Race version 3. You know, we are the World Championship Air Race. It is a new organization. It's a new championship. We're again working with the FAI, so the world's air sport governing body, has a 15-year sanction with us, which is fantastic. And we're working with them. They are our regulator in terms of rules and regulations and our sporting credibility. But I think it's as you say, we can learn on all the great bits from Red Bull, but also take the opportunity to advance on some of the bits that perhaps weren't picked up on because of other reasons back during the Red Bull era.
And I know also just to talk about the current times, you know, it would have been exciting to get going, but there's been a bit of an opportunity in this reprieve right now. I know that the team has been working furiously. Certainly last year, the things were getting together and gaining momentum. However, the way the world operates now, nothing could be done this year. But it's actually given a nice opportunity for you and the team to kind of go back to the drawing board and say, well, what things can we make better? We've got an extra year to figure this out. What can we make better? So let's talk about some of those things. Maybe we should start right at the top, right at the prime position, the teams. I love this new concept of a team, a race team. It speaks to Formula One, you know, Formula One motor racing. The team Mercedes has a driver, it's Lewis Hamilton, but they're not the same thing. Although Lewis is driving for Mercedes, Mercedes will drive whether Lewis is there or not. And Lewis, you know, while he works for Mercedes, he could race for any other team too. So tell us how you've brought that concept into World Championship Air Race.
Yeah, so previously the situation would be that the pilot was, if you like, front and center, the team. You know, of course, the pilot was dependent on a technician and a team coordinator and a tactician. But ultimately, the pilot was in the aeroplane on the track. And when the pilot said, I want to stop racing now, that was it. He left the series, gone completely. And everything that team had brought to the series went with it. All their experience, all their learning. All the benefits they gained just dissipated away. So what we want to do is say, well, no, actually the team, just because the pilot wants to stop racing, the team can still be there as a race team. The pilot jumps out the cockpit and another pilot can go in, like you say, just like in other motorsports. So we are much more of a team-based championship where the pilots can come and go out of the cockpit. If you're a high-performing pilot, you might be around for a bit longer than a poorly performing pilot who's at the end of the season, let go, I think, is the phrase they use. And of course, we have the second tier of racing, which is the GT series, where these team owners and principals can look into it and say, I'd like to hire you to come and be my pilot in the GP1 class. And that then provides a role of progression through. And then the ultimate sort of point of that journey then is we have the Air Race Academy, where we'll start to identify and bring on the new talent that will then feed into the GT series, that will then feed on into the GP1. So we're kind of creating this whole ecosystem of race team, race pilot creation.
That sounds great. And I know that there's a bit of a distinction on the GP1 and the Aero GT. So the GP1 being the format that people would be familiar with. They'll see it racing. And if you're not an aficionado, you might not even notice much difference at all. But talk us through then the Aero GT, the sort of challenger, as it were, the challenger series now, and how that's quite different. You bring in a bit of a Le Mans style to this.
Yeah, we just wanted to differentiate the two race classes. One of the issues that cropped up frequently going back to the Red Bull era was that the masterclass and the challenger class flew very similar aeroplanes on the same track and recorded pretty similar times. So it was kind of what's the difference between the two? So we decided straight off the bat, let's build in a significant air gap between these two race classes so that the fans can differentiate between the two. So the GP1 class, for a start, will still race with things like Zivco Edge V2s or V3s and MSX, you know, high-performance race planes. The GT class are going to be racing extra 300s, so slightly slower, slightly less performance, but still a very fast aeroplane to be racing through a track on. We will also provide these pilots into a team structure. So each GT classification team will have its own team principal who will also act as coach and mentor. And then there'll be three pilots in that team. And they will effectively run a relay race on the track. So they'll fly their track time, they'll land, they get out, another guy gets in, he goes off, and the track time accumulates. And the total team time at the end of it is the culmination of all three pilots' time. So it builds in a bit of a team dynamic. So you've got, you know, potentially a couple of guys going out there nailing it with fantastic track times. And then the third team member goes out and starts collecting pylons as he goes. And you know, and you then have that team dynamic of how do you deal with that? What does the team manager do? How do you react? How do you change the tactics as a team? How do you, you know, build that team structure differently? So it's something that's new. We're going to see how it works. It'd be great. You know, we're going to be very receptive to fan feedback. People might like it. People might not like it. But until we give it a try, we're not really going to know. But I think it's a good concept. At the end of that season, the top performing pilots in the GT class will be eligible in the draft for promotion and selection into GP1 if that's what a team owner wants to do.
Okay, and you mentioned that a former top class, the GP1 pilot would then be the mentor and the boss on the Aero GT. Would the Aero GT be a complete independent team, or is that run by World Champs Air Race, or is it a subsidiary of the main class team, or how do the teams differentiate there?
So the team will be, it's an independent team. We provide the assets, so there'll be WCAR-owned aeroplanes, and we'll control it. So, you know, we control who gets the licenses coming in to do the sport, but actually the team mentor, TP, will be given, you know, complete freedom to run his team or her team the way they want to do it.
Oh, it sounds very exciting and a nice opportunity, because almost you triple up the chances for people to get exposed and to be involved in this. I'm sure that there's, you get inundated, or maybe the combination of you and other people. How do I get involved in Red Bull Air Race, in World Champs Air Race? I want to do air racing. When I joined South African Air Race a few years ago, one of the pilots there, Glenn Dell, was flying in the Red Bull Air Race series, and it was just a wonderful thing for me to see. Well, here's a guy doing the same job as me. You know, why couldn't I do this? It becomes more tangible. So what do you say to people out there right now, or what's happening? Are you fielding a lot of requests? What is the message that goes out to people when they say, can I do this?
Yes, you can. Yeah, that's the answer is, of course you can.
That's wonderful.
I can't give too much away about pilot selection because we haven't announced that yet for this season. And I'm going to keep that under wraps for now. But one of the guys that flew in the Challenger class in the Red Bull Air Race, an Italian pilot called Dario Costa. And as a young boy, he went with his mother to Red Bull Air Race, and saw it and said, I want to do that. And he went and he did three jobs to earn the money, got a pilot's license, went into aerobatics, got another job to do, bring more money in. He then went and started working at Red Bull Air Race on the ground as one of the aviation ops managers, and then made his way into the cockpit. So he went from that young kid at an event going, I want to do that, and made it all the way to being a race pilot. So it can be done. Historically, there was quite a big focus on recruiting pilots that were already very successful aerobatic competition pilots.
Sure.
I think in the early days of the air race, when it was less structured, that was probably a very good and logical thing to do. But as the air race has progressed, I think there's been a recognition that you don't need to be a championship aerobatic pilot to be successful in the racetrack. And actually being a really successful aerobatic competition pilot doesn't mean you will be successful in the racetrack. So we're opening up the channels of recruitment. And now we're setting up a global network of air race academies where wannabe race pilots, they already have to be a pilot, and they already have had to have done some dynamic maneuvering, aerobatic type flight. And they can go to one of these academies and be assessed by an air race pilot of past or present, who will then say either, yeah, I think you're good enough to go to the UK for an evaluation camp, or I think, you know, fly with me for the next 5-10 hours and I'll give you a bit of experience, a bit more top tips, and then maybe you'll be good enough to go. So we start to get a route of recruitment of new pilots based on competence and attitude rather than solely their CV. And I think that's definitely the way we want to go. You know, we want to see younger people coming into the air race. So Steve Jones, the head of training, says, you know, the younger we can get them, the easier they are to train. They're far more receptive to learning the new skills in their early 20s. Once you start recruiting air race pilots into their mid 30s, you've kind of missed that boat. So we want to attract more young blood into the air race. And from all, you know, all areas, we want to diversify the pool of pilots as far as we can.
That sounds great. It's exciting news. And I'm sure people listening now will be hopping up and down thinking this is wonderful. And you've mentioned a few things. I want to zoom in. I know you don't have all the answers yet, but whatever you can share about it, that'll be great. The academy. So this will be the sort of entry level tier, the basic tier. It sounds to me, the way you described it a moment ago, that it will be almost like a franchise, fully licensed through you, but in various places around the world, not something that you're going to directly operate, but you'll have oversight into. Do I understand that correctly? Can you speak more about the academy and where they would be potentially in the world?
Yeah, so I mean, at the moment we're talking to guys that we could end up with a good 7 or 8 different academies dotted around the world. At the moment we don't have a full picture of what the appetite is to go to them, but that's starting to emerge. My inbox of applicants at the moment, just over 20 people have already been in touch saying, how do I become an air race pilot? Everybody that writes saying, how do I do it, gets a reply and goes into the pool to ready to go into the academy when it starts. So yeah, it'll be around the world. It is very much about just saying to somebody, I think that you've got what it, I think if you go to the training and evaluation camp where Steve Jones makes the decision on who's safe to be licensed or recommended to be licensed, then, you know, that's a great thing to do. We had the last training and evaluation camp I was involved with. We had two young pilots came to it. One of them came from the F-16 and one came from flying a Pitts S-1 on an airshow circuit. Both of them were phenomenally good. Sammy Mason, who was the American Pitts pilot, then joined the Challenger class at Red Bull and has done really well. I'd be surprised if we didn't see him around on a racetrack again. And if it hadn't been for other commitments, the young F-16 guy would have been put in a race plane as well. You know, he was, you know, within 2 or 3 days, he was down amongst the pylons racing pretty competitively. And up until about a month before that evaluation camp, he had never even flown in a tail dragger aerobatic aeroplane before.
Wow. Yeah. Well, it's very encouraging news, really. It's wonderful to hear, because I know people listening think, you know, I didn't make it into the Air Force. I'm 25 now. I'm just still working through my PPL, my CPL, whatever it is, but I really want to get involved in something. And what you're saying is like music to their ears, saying, you can do this. Put in the hard yards and focus and look out there and get in touch online with World Championships Air Race. I know that there's a big drive, media drive. There's lots of different channels where you can follow and get involved and keep up to date. And certainly this will be very encouraging news to a lot of people.
Yeah, either you can contact us through the website or, you know, DM us on one of the social media channels and we'll get right back to you. We respond to everything.
That's wonderful. Okay, now to talk a little bit more about some of the specifics going forward. I know you know you've talked about did we talk about aircraft? And I'm looking at these aircraft behind you. So you mentioned the V2, V3. Those are the sort of the main line. Is there any updates on the future of what is air racing? We talked about electrification. I know that's part of the vision. Is there anything you can share about sort of the longer term view about, you know, going green and but still being an awesome presence in the sky?
Yeah, we definitely want to engage with and bring in as much of this future tech that's coming in aviation development at the moment. You know, urban air mobility is growing rapidly, way faster than I expected it was going to grow. And we certainly have our vision on having an electric vertical takeoff and landing new race vehicle on our tracks, maybe within 4 or 5 years. We're currently working with a development partner in the US looking at building us an amazing race vehicles, and that's going to be fantastic. And we're also looking at options for going, you know, a stopgap electrification of the edges on the way to that point. We're currently, you know, scoping that piece of work with industry partners in the UK to see how we'd go around doing it. It's important that we do that. It's also important to recognise that, you know, we want to reduce our environmental footprint as a global traveling air race series. But it's important in that to recognize that only about 3% of our carbon footprint relates to the aeroplanes on the racetrack. There's an awful lot of carbon footprint you reduce by lightening the logistics footprint, by reducing the long haul flights that we take, by finding a different way of power generation for everything else around the racetrack. So there's a great deal of work that's currently going on to significantly reduce our carbon footprint based on the pre-existing Red Bull model. And then ultimately, yes, it'll extend to aeroplanes on the track. But actually, we don't want to have a disproportionate focus on reducing the environmental impact of, you know, a dozen aeroplanes compared to, you know, flying 140 people halfway around the world every month. So there's much more we need to do in the bigger picture of the event before we get too narrowly focused on one small part. But yeah, I think electrification is on the on the track, definitely. It's a part of the plan. And then eVTOL is next in line. The one thing that's different about our kind of motorsport from everything else, Alex, is that we, you know, technology is number one. So is the technology available? And already there's electric aeroplanes. Now, the electric aeroplanes out there at the moment don't fly at 250 miles an hour, plus or minus 12 Gs, and roll at 420 degrees per second. So they're not there yet, but we're working towards that. So is the technology ready? Is it commercially viable? I.e., is it affordable for us to put in the race? And the third and most important one for us is, once we've implemented that change, will the local aviation regulators that give us our permission to race say, yes, the safety case for that new air vehicle is still strong? Now, when you're building a safety case on a Zivco Edge airframe with a Lycoming 540 engine in it, you know, there are literally hundreds of thousands of flight hours that we can relate to for a safety case. And we've also got 16 years of Red Bull Air Race behind it as a safety case. So our risk assessment is pretty strong. When you start then saying to the regulator, no, this race is going to involve an air vehicle that we've never used before, and it hasn't really got much safety case history behind it, it's pretty easy for them then to say no. So what we need to do is be very cautious that we don't overstep that timeline and get too ahead of the game with the technology before we've actually got the regulator to say, yes, you can race this. Because our type of air racing is up close and personal. You know, we like to be within 200 meters of the crowd. That's that's what we aim to be. And that means that we're asking the regulator to give us a permission to go and do something that we need to demonstrate is definitely within their risk appetite. That's important.
And you'll be one of the very few people in the world that will be able to be doing the sort of demonstration of this and proving of this. And so how do you do that at the same time? So you make a good point there. If you put all your effort into something that's only got 3% of the impact, then you got to just do it, measuredly. But you've talked about being within 200 meters of the crowd line. So let's get into the actual exciting event. So 2022, this is around the corner. I mean, already people on the media are following on the buzz that's happening right now. You've had a few press statements. Tell us about an air show event, a race event. World Championship Air Race arrives in a city. And, what happens the days before? Is it weeks before? People coming, you're getting involved in local schools. Tell us about some of the exciting things that you want to bring, that it's not just race day, but everything else.
Yeah, so the planning takes a long time. A year out, we're starting to plan with the host cities, and we'll be announcing those in the coming months and where we're going to be. But host city is about finding a partnership where we come in and do what we want to do in terms of racing, but also promote the city in a way it wants to be promoted, whether that's as a technology hub or a tourism hub or both. It's working with that local government to say, how can we come and be a really good partner for your city to promote what you're doing and excite your public? You know, the feedback that we get after air racing is always phenomenal. Very, very high approval ratings, people getting really excited by what they've seen. There's a lot of planning to be done. There's planning around two key locations. There's the racetrack, which is based on something called the race box. And the race box is a volume, 3D volume box. It's about a kilometer long, 600 meters deep, and about 1,000 feet high. And that's where we'll build our racetrack in there. And we do that anyway. I mean, the beauty about air racing, unlike other motorsports, is that, you know, the whole of the planet's covered in sky. So we're not restricted to flying on a race circuit or on a river or on a lake. We can race anywhere. Anywhere the regulator says that's okay to come and race here, we can race in the sky. Predominantly we race over lakes, coastal waters or rivers, but also we race on land as well. We just need a space that's that big. But generally, you know, if you want to get up close with people, then a nice beachfront or a waterfront is an ideal location. And then we've got the race airport. So we need to find somewhere that's got a 700 meter long landing strip. Quite often, not an airport, not an existing airfield. It might be the start finish straight on a motor racing circuit. It might be the promenade in front of a beach. It might be a main road that gets closed down. You know, we'll just find a 700 meter strip of what we're doing. If I think back to one of the most interesting ones was in Kazan in Russia, where the runway was on a sloping start finish line on a motor racing circuit in the bottom of a quarry.
Wow.
Yeah, that I mean, it was
so yeah. You guys are flexible. You're saying you can do the job.
Yeah. So we just have to find somewhere we can go and put that in. So then we have the event production team that will go out there and actually plan the sites. You know, where do we put staging? Where do we put seating? Where do we put the chalets? Where do we put the signs and the sound and all that kind of stuff? The track people. So Marco and his team at Aqua Events, they've got to go out and scout the water. You know, is it a sandy bottom, a rocky bottom? Are there cables or pipes? It's quite an in-depth bit of work to actually survey where the race box is going to go. We're going to anchor these big pylon rafts in there. Each pylon's 35 meters high. These are big structures. So we've got to get them in place. And then as we get towards race event, about a month before the event production team start arriving, the logistics starts arriving. And then really with about a week to go, a week and a half to go, the airport starts taking shape with the hangars being put up, the pit lane being created, the race box being established. And then race day minus five, the race teams arrive. They start building their aeroplanes because obviously the aeroplanes have been delivered inside a 747 freighter with the wings removed and the tail removed, all strapped down on pallets.
Sorry to interrupt you. I just want to say that my heart rate is getting higher and higher. It's elevated right now. When you start talking about airplanes arriving and unpacking, I'm feeling like I'm back in that air show environment, watching it, smelling it, feeling it, tasting it. This is incredible, Willie. So carry on. This is an amazing conversation.
In real life, it is. So the race airport on the last day of race airport construction has a vibe. The next day when the teams are in there and the planes are being unpacked, it's transforms. It then becomes into an airport, and this is an airport that might be in a city center or in a quarry. Yeah. Anyway, and it's, and that's a really exciting bit of work. So the airplanes have got to be built. There's all the briefings to be done. And then the pilots take the airplanes off for shakedown flights. They've got to just go out there and A, check the airplanes are okay, and then build up their G tolerance. They're going to spend the next 3 or 4 days, up at 12 G's some of the time. So they're getting their G tolerance done. And then we work towards then getting onto the track for a bit of testing and practice. And then we're into race weekend. So there's all that stuff going on. There's a lot of race activation going on, whether that's engaging with local schools as part of our outreach education program, or providing lectures places, or providing flypasts over the city to promote the race, and all that kind of stuff's going on. And then we get into race weekend itself. And that can be anything. So, look back at, classic races before, racing in Porto on the river in Porto with, nearly a million spectators lining the banks of the river, watching that air race weekend. Or it could be somewhere like a motor speedway stadium in the US where you've got 20 or 30,000 people, but they're in stadiums looking down on a racetrack where they used to see cars driving around in circles. So it's that kind of location fits in. We're adaptable and we'll fit wherever we can. And then the next sort of new thing that we're bringing into this is recognizing that if families are going to be coming to the air race and being there all day, we don't want them to go home at 4 or 5 o'clock when the racing's finished. The party's just starting. So now we're linking up with the music festival partner. And we then go on into an evening of really, top A-list music festival going on into the evening. And then we pack it away and do it all again the next day.
That sounds incredible. I can't wait for this to begin. The point that you want to bring in the local community, flypasts over schools, maybe some lectures in some schools, bring in people that ordinarily wouldn't get a chance to be around aeroplanes just to smell it and taste it and touch it. And it's just a wonderful opportunity, and it must be a great thing. And are you getting requests from cities all around the world? Are you getting flooded? Please bring it here. How do people go about doing that? What's the best approach to get your name known as a city that wants an air race?
Yeah, so we've currently got a long list at the moment of 28 cities that are on that list at the moment that we're narrowing down. We want to race in 8 for the first season, maybe 9, but probably 8, and that's, that'll be announced which those successful 8 are in the coming months. And it's a good mix of old and new locations, places we've raced before and places that have never held an air race, but are phenomenal, iconic locations for something like an air race. And it's great to see the interest level. And more cities coming online all the time. Again, we've got to contact us through the website or through social media. If there's any city goes, hey, why don't you come and race here? Talk to us. like I said, all we need to find is that space somewhere in the city we can come and build a track, and we'll be there.
I have a feeling that you're going to get flooded after this episode goes live. So good luck dealing with it. And I think it's going to be a wonderful opportunity. So we spoke a bit about a calendar. You can't give away anything yet. There'll be an announcement coming soon. But I get the sense that this is littered all over the world. This is not concentrated in a certain area. Is there a goal to reach every sort of space of the world? Or is it just kind of working out that way?
No, there is a goal to reach every space of the world. And there are parts of the world that are places not been raced in before. I mean, we'd love to go and do a race in India. You know, working with you guys, would love to come and race in Cape Town. You know, that would be one that we'd love to get squared away as well as, you know, moving into the China and parts like that. We're not an American or European centric race. We will race at locations all over the world. It's a world championship, and it's exactly what it's going to be.
That sounds amazing. Now, I know that you're also planning a bit of a launch, a get-together, a bit of a media buzz coming in the summer, the European summer. Is there anything you can share about us just to keep us going until that occurs?
So we haven't nailed down an exact date yet. You might not be aware, or your viewers might not be aware, but we are still in COVID lockdown over here in the UK. We've got severely restricted movements and what we can do in groups. So we currently have a nominal date when that sort of terminates and we can get back to some sort of level of normality when we could do a live launch event here in the UK. So we're just monitoring that at the moment, and we'll be announcing that date with a good couple of months to go before the event happens. But yeah, we're going to have a live event here at Sidewell Airfield where we can bring in people and see what we're really doing.
Oh, that's amazing. That's really going to be nice. Looking forward to that. Just a question on, I know that the first season is the build up, eight, maybe nine cities. Considering that maybe not the whole world will be as advanced as other places to get the sort of vaccinations, etc. Do you foresee that even though a city has agreed, if they're not in a position to have crowds, would you do an event knowing that the value can still bring to your race organization and the city, even though it's a bit more virtual and online rather than in-person event?
That's not kind of a binary yes, no answer to that one, Alex. I think every city will be taken on its own merits to see how that works. Every city race has a completely unique business model around how that race works. So we'll certainly look at each case. But yes, I think I would say that just because there aren't large crowds permitted to attend doesn't mean that the race wouldn't go ahead. But this is very much a partnership. You know, the air race and the host city are partners in this event, and it's about how we work together to do whatever is the right thing to do. It's not about us making that decision and saying we're going to come regardless. It's about working with the city partners and saying, hey, what do we do? How do you want to play this? At the moment, the cities we're talking to are relatively optimistic, as are we, that starting in February next year seems to be a realistic timeline to plan on. But obviously, we've got contingencies in place for pretty much every eventuality we have to face it.
And two more points that I want to bring out, then we can sign off this wonderful conversation. Willie, I know that there's an event planned. Is there anything you can share towards the end of the year, the sort of first proper training camp once you've done the launch mid-year, and then getting down to the nuts and bolts? The team can shake things down. You can practice your track setup, etc. Anything you can share with us on that?
Yeah, so before the first race, there will have to be a training and evaluation camp where we evaluate the new technology. So we're working with a bunch of guys that we've worked with before. They're called Octuple, and they are race technology development company, and they're developing brand new race technology to go in every aeroplane that gathers all the data from that aeroplane that we can use for judging, but also it helps the team to download and use for their tactical evaluation. It also gives us a new TV feed. We're really pleased to be working with a major UK TV production company called Aurora Media Worldwide. And you know, we're currently working with them and Octuple to look at what the camera setup is going to be on the aeroplane. It could be significantly bigger and more exciting than anything anyone's seen before. We want to give a much more immersive feeling when you're engaging with the air race on your whatever streaming platform you're on, TV or your iPad or phone or laptop, whatever it might be. So we need to check that all that gets integrated and works properly before the first race. And we also need to get the pilots back on the track just to get back in the groove. So we'll be doing that somewhere in probably, I would think, October, November this year. We just have to nail down the date and the location. There's a couple of options that we're looking at the moment, but that those tend not to be open to the public events, but we'll, you know, we'll certainly provide televised coverage of what we're doing, get people involved, lots of behind the scenes activity. And that's part of what we want to do in our different form of air racing, is provide a much more behind the scenes interactive element of how fans can engage with the race. You know, there is so much to what makes an air race exciting than just seeing aeroplanes flying through pylons on the track. And I'm not just referring to landing in quarries. You know, there's a lot of exciting stuff. You know, seeing elite athlete sportsmen, these pilots, and when I say athletes, I mean these guys are subjecting their bodies to 12 G's on a regular basis, 12 times the weight of gravity pulling down on them. They've got to be super fit guys to go and do this over a whole race week. So they definitely deserve to be recognized as elite athletes. And you know, it's important that they're in the right physical shape to go and do this. But also, you know, we can provide an insight into how they do that. How do you train to be an air race pilot? Some of the guys already on the social media streams put out some really weird and wonderful techniques that they use to get their hand-eye coordination, their fine motor skills, their G tolerance. How do you do all that when you're not on a racetrack every day? And it's important that we can share those stories. So there's going to be an awful lot of, you know, additional content that we can share with people to provide maybe a greater detail of insight into what it's like to be an air race pilot.
Sure. I look forward to that. And certainly the way tech's moving, I mean, the camera technology alone, never mind the opportunity for the data feed. And certainly I can envisage, if you're not at the live event, if you're watching it on TV, you're not watching on one screen. It's two or three screens. It's, you know, it's a TV with maybe an iPad and a phone, looking at the telemetry data here, the video coverage on the main screen, and you can get a bit more immersed. And I think that people really do buy into this idea of digging deep into something. If you're passionate about something, you really dig deep these days. And if you want to understand what makes the hand-eye coordination better of the sort of top three pilots, what is it that they do? And how could I improve my own game of golf, squash, tennis, or whatever by using a technique from a high-performance environment like air racing? I think it's amazing. And then again, just the point of being an athlete, chatting with Ben Murphy last year, there was a discussion in his team that said, if you lose 7 kilograms, it's going to make a difference. And he was already in good shape, but he set about and lost the 7 kilograms, and life got better for him as a race pilot. So wonderful tidbits that you could share with the viewing public, and being involved in an app and a data source and watching it the live feed. I can't wait. It sounds amazing.
Mm, yeah, we're looking forward to doing all that work. It's going to be really exciting.
Now, last point, I'm going to push you on this and let's see where this lands. So I believe we have an announcement to make. Are you ready? I know we can't announce all the pilots, but are we able to share something with the listeners about who is the lineup? Have we got any special names that we can mention that we're looking forward to watching in the 2022 inaugural season of the World Championship Air Race?
I'll give you one. Why don't I let you, I'll let one out of the bag. So I'm really pleased that we're going to have reigning world champion Matt Hall coming back and racing with his team in the new World Championship Air Race. It's going to be great to have Matt back. Great pilot, military guy as well. You know, flew F-18s in the Australian Air Force, flew F-15s on exchange with the Americans, got an amazing flying background, had a great season in 2019. And it's great to have Matt Hall coming back. And hopefully you'll be able to find out a little bit about him yourself.
That'll be great. I'm really excited to hear that news, Willie. It's great to have the reigning champ back. And then obviously he becomes the sort of marked man and he's the one everyone's going for. But as with everyone else, he's got to learn the new rules, the new environment. And yeah, great to hear that announcement. So we look forward to further engagement with the World Championship Air Race and social media platforms. Where's the best place for people to find you, to find the teams, to get involved with the race pilots, the organization, and to keep up to date with what's happening?
Social media, go to @TheAirRace, to @TheAirRace, or just Google World Championship Air Race and find us on the internet.
Oh, that's wonderful. Willie, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. We've learned a lot from your background and I can see just in this conversation the amount of detail that's gone into it and really looking forward to the new iteration of what is a premier racing event, the fastest motorsport on the planet, and looking forward to it. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Alex. It's been great to talk. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. I'm excited to have you on this journey with us. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and remember to subscribe to the show to catch weekly episodes so that you can build your high performance team.